From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Of the nearly 1 million physicians who practice medicine in the U.S., about 25% were trained in foreign medical schools. That's according to a 2018 report by the American Immigration Council. But immigrant doctors face high barriers to entry in this country, which is a concern for states like Georgia, which has a severe shortage of doctors. Andy Miller is editor of Georgia Health News. Freelance journalist Max Blau is here with Max and Andy. They recently published a five-part series on immigrant doctors in Georgia. And thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here, Max.
Great to have you with us. And I'm going to start with you, Andy. I mean, this is a five-part series. That's a resource-intensive thing. Why did you decide to focus on foreign-born doctors?
Well, the three of us, and I'm including Katja Ritterbusch, Max and myself, all came at this from kind of different angles, but we all kind of had, each of us, a separate idea that this was an important story, the fact that foreign-born doctors provide a substantial amount of care in Georgia and across the country. And so we got together and mapped this out. And remember, during the political campaign season, there were two big themes, immigration being one, healthcare being another. And so this was a kind of convergence of those two themes in terms of what we wanted to work on. And basically, we wanted to take a deep dive and see what work and what barriers this substantial amount of immigrant physicians provide here, both Georgia specifically and nationally.
Right. And it's 17% of the doctors practicing now in Georgia are foreign-born. The entire country is facing a doctor shortage. How bad is it in Georgia, Andy?
Well, it's worse here. Because, for one thing, our population is increasing substantially year to year, and there are many areas of the state that have particular shortages of primary care doctors. There are six counties that have no physicians, six of 159. There about one-third of our counties have no pediatrician, and then about half of the counties have no OBGYN. So this creates a real access to care problem, particularly for people with chronic disease.
Max, why is it so high here in Georgia?
It's the combination of two main factors. It's our population in Georgia is aging, and it is also, with that, the doctor workforce is aging as well, and that in the near future, you're going to have, nationally, the crisis of the shortage of doctors looks like it'll be about 120,000 nationwide. And when you look at Georgia specifically, the shortage that could happen here is one that will particularly hit rural parts of the state particularly hard. So it's the combination of aging population and aging doctors.
And it seems like a lot of foreign-born doctors seem to cluster in the Northwest, certain places in the Midwest, not so much here in Georgia. So one of the thoughts is that more foreign-born doctors, those trained overseas, could be allowed to practice medicine here in the U.S. Who wants to walk me through the steps of what it would actually take to get there?
So typically, much like any other doctor or medical student who is going through the process, you would have to complete a series of four different exams that are part of what is known as MLE or medical licensing exams. Then you would have to get into a three-year residency program and complete that at a hospital, typically at a hospital of around the state that offers that kind of teaching for residents. And then at that point, you'd be eligible to get your medical license typically. Many foreign-born doctors have in some way, shape, or form gone through a similar process in a different country. Mm-hmm. When they come to the U.S., though, they need to complete the residency requirements, and getting into residency programs typically for foreign-born doctors or anyone who was born outside of this country is statistically harder to do than mm-hmm. to be a U.S.-born medical student or resident and go through the same steps.
So you would have done a residency in your home country, and then you have to come and do it in the U.S. again.
Exactly. And in many cases, doctors who are trained to practice in other countries do the whole, they've completed all their medical education in a different country, and then they come here and do it all over again.
So that must be pretty costly. You study for an exam, maybe not be able to practice medicine while doing so, going through residency. Andy, what do we know about what these doctors do to make ends meet during that time?
Well, some actually do other jobs. We've profiled folks that work in research and basically in other type of jobs while they're trying to get into a residency program. I mean, that's the real bottleneck. And unfortunately, federal funding for residency programs hasn't really increased. And that causes a real problem for these folks that have been trained in foreign countries such as India. They come here, they want to practice medicine here. And unfortunately, they're stuck in terms of trying to get into a residency program.
Are the exams in the U.S. more rigorous than in other countries, residency requirements and exams, for example?
I would say the bigger problem is getting that residency program rather than passing the exams. I mean, these folks, and Max has profiled one that did a lot of training and was actually doing physician work where in his home country. And unfortunately, he has not been accepted.
Is that Iraj Ghani, the Iranian gentleman that you spoke to? So tell us about him and the decision he had to make about getting approved for a green card to the U.S. in the first place.
So Iraj was a orthopedic surgeon back in Tehran, where he was born and did all his medical education. And in 2009, he won the lottery. He was one of 50,000 people who had applied to come to the U.S. and was fortunate enough to have the chance to come here. But he also had this tough choice at that point in time. It was either continuing to be a doctor in his home country, something he had spent 16 years training to do to get up to being a specialist, or come here and potentially become a doctor again, but also being aware of some of the risks at that time that, you know, while it would be difficult to become a doctor, he believed it would be something that was still attainable for him. And at this point in time, he's been going through the process for 7 years at this point, and he has still not been able to even get into a residency program.
Do we know how many just give up after that kind of all those many hoops to jump through?
I've chatted with five or six other doctor or people who want to become doctors in the U.S. who had been doctors in other countries, and some choose paths like becoming a nurse practitioner and ones that are below their pay grade from their other country. And some just leave the profession altogether. I chatted with one who is now running like a laundromat in Arizona, for instance, which has nothing to do with being a doctor at all.
About 17% of practicing physicians in Georgia were born in another country. Well, we'd like to know from you, do you know if your doctor was born or trained in a country other than the U.S.? And does that matter to you? Let us know. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can also leave us a message. We're at 404-500-9457. So one of the potential solutions is that some doctors envision creating an assistant physician program. That this would help offset the doctor shortage, especially outside of Metro Atlanta. What would that look like?
An assistant physician program is one in which a doctor like Iraj, for instance, could see patients. He could, under the supervision of a doctor who had gone through a U.S. residency program as well as passed the licensing to become a doctor, he or she would not be able to prescribe without a doctor overseeing them's authorization. And depending on how it would work, there would be a certain geographic limit to where they could practice, but theoretically would be in a rural area that didn't have enough doctors at this point in time.
Go ahead, Andy.
No, in Georgia, it was proposed that we create that, and I think it's probably still on the table, at least in the background, but there are a few states that have created this assistant physician position, and so far, it seems to be working well there.
Who oversees certification for that kind of thing or approval?
Well, it would be that the legislature would have to create this category by law, and have it passed through the General Assembly and signed into law.
So state legislature.
Yeah. Right. And then ultimately the medical board, like all other medical licenses, would have regulatory authority over this process or the license.
How do patients tend to talk about this? You know, do you speak to them about being concerned about the qualifications of a foreign-born doctor, for example?
Well, I think that we did talk to some patients. Particularly, I went to a Clarkston clinic which serves many uninsured immigrants and refugees, and you know they're tremendously pleased and satisfied by being able to get care at this Clarkston Community Health Center.
Where
most of the doctors are foreign born.
Right, and I'm wondering about whether the travel ban imposed by the Trump administration against immigrants from select Muslim countries has affected any of those that, for example, you spoke with.
Well, I think that there have been some visa problems created by the travel ban. There have been some we talked to doctors, particularly we talked to one who is from Libya. And that's one of the countries that has been isolated by President Trump and his travel ban. And while he had some difficulty in terms of getting his visa to practice after he did his residency, he did make it. And these are folks that want to stay in our country and want to deliver patient care.
I know that many of these doctors have patients in areas of Georgia that tend to lean conservative and wondered how they have reacted to foreign doctors, especially to Muslim healthcare providers.
Well, that's a good question. And I think what the Muslim physicians told us is that basically they're accepted by those communities. I mean, sometimes they run into awkwardness and, you know, they may have a patient or two that doesn't want to be served by a Muslim doctor. And some of them talked to me about that, including one who said that the whole atmosphere kind of changed after 9/11 and patients were there were a number of patients that were more reluctant to be seen by a Muslim physician.
At the same time, I think you see this phenomenon where, so let's say, in Katja, in her story, she talked to a doctor in Stewart County, and I believe he's one of the only doctors in this 6,000 county area. And you see what, there'd be this disconnect, maybe even a wariness or a mistrust that exists of someone who is not like you treating you, but as soon as that connection happens in a patient room. Oftentimes, that is, you know, is a bridge across two different cultures or that may have not existed previously.
It tends to break things down. So we have just a minute here, Andy. You, of course, editor of the Georgia Health News, and since we have you, the deadline to enroll for coverage in the Affordable Health Care Act is this Saturday, December 15th. So, what are you at Georgia Health News watching?
Well, we're seeing that the number of people enrolling is less than it was the previous year. Now, that may be a lot of factors involved. It could be the fact that the tax penalty has gone away if you don't get insurance. It could be the reduction in funding for navigators, which is our insurance counselors that go to hard to enroll populations and help them enroll. But so we don't think there will be as many people signing up this year as last year in Georgia. Last year, we had like 480,000.
Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News. Max Blau, who collaborated with another reporter on a five-part series on foreign doctors in Georgia. That's all at GeorgiaHealthNews.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Pasquale Pat Pascarella trained under Eric Ripert at Le Bernardin in New York City. He earned his Southern street cred as executive chef at The Optimist in Atlanta and then went on to open White Bull in Decatur. White Bull churns its own butter and mills flour from Georgia red wheat. The menu changes to reflect what it can buy from farmers across the state. So when we asked Chef Pat to choose one essential Southern food for our main ingredient series, he threw us a little twist. Instead of the country ham that is the centerpiece on many a Southern Christmas table, he chose Ossabaw pork from a Spanish breed of pig that evolved in isolation on Ossabaw Island in South Georgia. We'll let him take it from here.
Hi, I'm Pat Pasquarello, the executive chef and partner at the White Bull, and my ingredient is the Ossabaw pork. So we're starting the entire dish process itself. So the pork we cook ahead of time. It takes about 3 hours to cook. We do something called a porchetta. So you take the belly, you take the skin off, stuff it with sausage, a bunch of herbs, Parmesan cheese, and breadcrumbs, and then roll it into each other, and then slow roast it in the oven. So basically what I'm doing is I'm starting the pickled mustard seed crema that's going with it. There's a farm that we use called Day Spring Farm. They overgrew soybeans last year, so we're helping them use it up. So a lot of times people use soybeans and they'll make soy sauce, stuff like that. We're trying to use a different method of actually braising it and using it like cannellini beans or something like that. So we did a little bit of tomato in there, a bunch of garlic, a lot of onions, and just give it a ton of flavor. And then I'm going to fry some shishito peppers, and I'm going to sear the porchetta itself.
They pop a lot.
The cool thing about shishito is it's like roulette. So like one out of every 40 is like piping hot, and it's like almost unbearable to eat. But it's like, it's worth it. They're so tasty. So, and they don't need anything. They literally need salt and like maybe a little bit of lemon, but that's it. They don't really need much work at all, which is good. They're an easy menu item, and everyone in Atlanta grows it, literally.
Ossabaw pigs are the same breed used for Spain and Portugal's famed jamón ibérico, or Iberian ham. It is loaded with fatty acids and omega-3s, and its fat is so unsaturated that it nearly turns to liquid and melts at room temperature and in the mouth.
So Ossabaw came here, I believe it was in the 1600s, and it was brought over by the Spanish, and it is an Iberian pig. It's a direct DNA match. It's a small pig, you know, it's full of flavor. It's got, you know, it mostly feeds on acorns, and I mean, literally you can taste how sweet the meat is. It's pretty remarkable. Like, the meat itself is so sweet, it feels like they've been eating sugar their entire lives, and now it's all over our menu all the time. So we'll do them probably about 2.5-3 minutes on both sides, and then we'll throw them in the oven to finish cooking, and then you let it rest like a minute and a half, 2 minutes, and you're ready to plate. I grew up basically like in a garden. You know, I mean, I grew up around, you know, chickens. I grew up around baby cows. I grew up around tons of vegetables. I mean, I still remember the first time I ate a tomato. I was 4 years old. I remember the feeling of that, like, tomato water just exploding in your mouth. And then I think for me, the most life-altering moment was when I was 5 and I was hanging out with my cousins, and we used to play a game where, like, you know, like tag, and then, you know, base was underneath the kitchen table. So lucky for me, that day my grandmother was rolling gnocchi and one piece fell on the floor, and I'm like, I'm not going to tell her, I'm going to eat it. And I ate it. I mean, I got smacked for it because I wasn't allowed to eat stuff off the floor, but it was a raw piece of gnocchi kind of like changed my life when it came to food in general. Like, I still remember her making it with tomato sauce. And it was just like, wow, I can't believe, like, this is cheese and flour. This is insane. I was taught so young to respect everything that's on a plate. And then once I started really thinking about food in a different nature of, like, how I could actually do this for a living, my parents hated it. They shunned me for it literally for, like, 5 years. They were like, no way, you can't do it. You know, I basically told my father that if he paid for my culinary school, that I'd make him a partner in my first two restaurants. And I did. And he cashed in multiple times for it. But he did. He paid for half of my culinary school. It was a 6-month education. It was $45,000. So I had to come up with half. And then he came up with the other half. And it was the best decision I ever made.
This was the basting part. You get all the rosemary and the garlic flavored in the oil. And then you take all that butter and flavor and you baste it. And you get all that flavor all over the pork. Because basically you already did the inside part when you brined the animal. So now it's just basting the outside with all the flavor of the garlic and the rosemary. And the cool part about it is that the butter starts to brown, so it adds like a really nice, like, nutty flavor to it. And it just gives it a really cool shine. I mean, look at the shine on that right now is incredible. So you just let that rest, and then we can start plating.
farm to table is not, is, there's no such thing of it anymore. Everybody should be farm to table. You know, I mean, every single person should understand that if you buy locally, not one, is it cheaper, but two, you're just getting a better product. I grew up literally in a garden. Like, I grew up in a garden. I almost believe that I was born in one. Like, any house that we've ever owned growing up, my parents, we made sure that the garden was the most important thing. We made sure that we didn't buy anything. My father was super, super anal, and my mom, about not buying stuff from grocery stores. I mean, like, to the point where, like, we were in the middle of the city with chickens, and, like, chickens would get out and run in the middle of the street. Just little things like that. And I grew up around it so much, and I just felt like, you know, I've really wanted to bring that to Atlanta when I got here. So I reached out to a lot of farmers that do it and try to have that same mentality and that same, you know, thought on life, is that, you know, you're never going to get anything better than what you grew. And the fact is that, you know, we have some incredible farmers here, some people that really do care and that really do give, you know what, about what it is that they're doing. And we want to showcase that. I mean, you know, I mean, we make sure that every single dish that we have comes from a farm. And people are really, like, loving the idea right now, which is great. We're going to plate it. The soybean ragu, basically the braise that we have, is just going to be a little bit on the bottom of the plate. Enough of that sauce as well to kind of leak out a little bit and to kind of drizzle around. And we're going to get the pork next. Plate the pork. This is the green kimchi aioli. Just a little dollops here or there. It's going to be a surprise when you're eating and you're like, ooh, what was that? Everybody up north has fried chicken and waffles on their menu. Nobody does it right. Nobody has a clue on how to do it right. But we kind of encountered it there. And I'm like, man, I can't wait to come down here and actually have real fried chicken and waffles. And then when I got here and I'm like, you know, there's a couple places that do it, but the South isn't really about fried chicken and waffles. It's actually more about vegetables, if you think about it. It's about really good pork. It's about fried chicken, but, I mean, it's not what the South is about. I realized very quickly how close to Italian cuisine the South really is, because they basically share the same climate. So, you know, I mean, like, they don't have to cover their fig trees here, just like they don't have to cover their fig trees in Italy. You know, just things like that. And it was relatively mind-blowing to me, because I was like, oh my God, I was like, I should have just been here my entire life. It just made more sense. It just felt like I was here all along. And we'll do the shishitos scattered all over. And then our little herb and seed salad that we're going to do. It's going to add texture to the dish. That's mint and Thai basil. And then the showstopper of the popcorn on top. So we'll garnish with popcorn a lot, just because, I mean, it's cool and it's fun. I mean, the cool thing is, like, we try to take our food very serious, but we don't take ourselves serious at all. So, like, that's, like, kind of our way of, like, showing that, like, you know, we like to joke around too. And it's incredible, and it's a cool texture that, like, you're not expecting. And then all of a sudden you get it and you're like, wow, popcorn actually does make sense here. So, and that's the entire dish.
Chef Pat Pasquarella, co-owner of White Bull in Decatur Square, for our main ingredient series. You can see photos from our trip to White Bull at gpbnews.org. The holidays are just around the corner, and Jocelyn Jackson has some new titles to add to your reading list. She's author of multiple works, including The Almost Sisters and The Opposite of Everyone. Here are her recommendations for our Southern Reading List. That's our series of authors and readers sharing books that define and reflect the South.
Sometimes I think we aren't aware of all the history around us every minute, and just how deep the blood is soaked into this black, rich soil we live on. And so when I think about reading the South, I was thinking about, like, how different books that where history or the past is almost a character, or it has a presence, or they are actual historicals. Hello, I'm Jocelyn Jackson, and I'm here today to tell you a few of my favorite Southern reads. I would recommend You and I and Someone Else by Anna Schachner. It is, it's set in the Lowcountry, and In this book, the way the past informs the present is very, very personal. It's very much a book about family. Genre-wise, I would call it, it's literary fiction, but it's that kind of accessible, super readable literary fiction. Oftentimes, it's called upmarket fiction. I think the writing is beautiful. It's about a young woman, Franny, who, in order to craft her own story or change her own story, she has to sort of retell the story of her parents. I'm going to read just a little piece of it because I think my favorite thing about this book is just the writing is so pretty. She sat and gazed at the restaurant and the ocean and the lights of Charleston dotted on the sea. The salt from the water and air settled heavily on her body like the coat she wished she had brought along. There would always be a part of my father she wouldn't understand, she decided. She had known that when she married, and she would accept that. She would allow him that. She could better picture herself, her life even, if she had to work at knowing him. But what frightened her was that her child, the one growing inside her, might be the same. He had no doubt that I would be a girl. My mother did. In fact, in perfect role reversal, my mother stared the nearly 50-50 probability straight in the eye and questioned the very suggestion of balanced odds. As she saw it, the fact that she had tricked my father into parenthood, having planned my conception without asking for his complicity, would tip the scales in his favor. I would be a boy, she was sure. He'll probably look like you too, she told my father. He'll get those long, wasted eyelashes. I love her matter-of-fact, blunt, bold tone. The writing is so accessible, but what she does thematically is so complicated and layered. It's really quite nice. The next one I want to recommend is definitely a different genre. It is science fiction. And part of it's actually set in California. It's Kindred by Octavia Butler. I'm in two book clubs. I'm in my neighborhood book club, and I'm in a classics book club. And I think that's kind of a neat thing to do, especially as a person who writes books for a living. I was looking for ways to be more engaged as a reader because sometimes, like, reading was always my first love and my greatest joy. And it's, I mean, I spent most of my childhood with my nose buried in a book. Being in these book clubs gives me this feeling of the kind of reading that's not part of my job. Like, I read a lot for my job just to stay current on trends and what's happening and what all my friends are doing. And sometimes I forget, you know, what a magic experience it is. And these book clubs sort of ground me. They give me people to talk about stuff with. And we chose Kindred in the Classics Book Club. It's the story of a young woman, modern. It was written in the 1970s, so take modern with a grain of salt. But she's a young African-American woman living in California. And she sort of gets stuck in time. And she gets pulled back to the antebellum South, where she intersects with her own family of origin. It's probably Octavia Butler's best known work, but any Octavia Butler that exists, you should probably read it. She's amazing. This was my first book of hers I'd ever read, and now I'm sort of in the middle of reading everything she ever wrote because it's so great. I'm just going to read you the opening of this. I love her matter-of-fact, blunt, bold tone. The writing is so accessible, but what she does thematically is so complicated and layered. It's really quite nice. I lost an arm on my last trip home, my left arm. I lost about a year of my life and much of the comfort and security I had not valued until it was gone. When the police released Kevin, he came to the hospital and stayed with me so I would know I hadn't lost him, too. And the last trip home that she's talking about, what she means by home, sort of unfolds over the course of the book. I love it. It's a book I'm keeping on my shelf that I'll probably reread rather endlessly. The last book I want to suggest, it's not even a book so much. Well, it is a book. It's a specific book, but it's by author Tayari Jones. She is now local, I believe. She's either moved here or she's moving soon to take a position at Emory, and she's from Atlanta. And her most famous book is definitely An American Marriage. It might even still be on the New York Times list right now. I am here to tell you not to stop there. I've been reading Tayari Jones since her first novel, and I think that's, after you finish An American Marriage, or you've probably already read it, go back and read her other books, especially this first one. It's called Leaving Atlanta, and it's set here at the time of the Atlanta child murders, and it's narrated by three kids who are in that sort of dangerous target age group. It is a beautiful, heartbreaking, really character-driven, intimate portrait of what it was like for these kids growing up inside of this thing that was happening. But it also just gets very much into their lives and who they are as people. They're all very, very real.
That was Jocelyn Jackson, author of The Almost Sisters. We used Red City Theme and City Limits by Blue Dot Sessions for music. If you have recommendations for our Southern reading list, let us know on our Facebook group or at OSD Talk on Twitter. Coming up, a little look back at the year in art and looking forward to holiday art shows. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. For many people, the season of giving is followed by seasons of debt. Tomorrow, we're going to get some insights into avoiding that particular holiday hangover. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you feel pressured to go all out for holiday gifts and parties? Are you gifting time or homemade gifts instead? You can tweet us at OST Talk or leave us a voicemail. We're at 404-500-9457, and we might feature your comments on tomorrow's show. There is, of course, much more to the season than shopping, and today we have some ideas for holiday events in and around Atlanta, along with highlights from the year in Georgia's culture scene from theater critic and ATL Arts ATL contributor Kalundra Smith. Hello, Kalundra.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Very well. Glad to have you with us. Floyd Hall covers culture for a number of publications. He's also an Arts ATL contributor and co-host of the Blacklanta podcast. He's joining us from Miami, where Art Basel wrapped yesterday. Do I say Basel or Basel, Floyd?
It is Basel, for all that we know.
Just wanted to make sure. Cardi B's been there, Kanye, Jennifer Lopez, all seen at Art Basel. So what's it like there with the high rollers? What's the scene?
Well, I'm not necessarily a high roller, but I have been in the same environments and checking out some of this amazing art. And it's been great to see really a very strong Atlanta contingent in Miami. So a lot of great art, just a feast for the eyes. And for those who have the means, a feast for the wallets as well.
Well, tell us about how Georgia was represented, because a pretty interesting kind of installation or exhibition set up there with Tila House.
Yeah, so Tila Studios is an arts incubator that's based in East Point. And for this year, for Art Basel, they brought 10 artists from Atlanta, 10, they call them the Garden Fellows. And so these are 10 Black women artists who were in Miami and were involved in an amazing slate of programming. One of them in particular took place at the Perez Art Museum, Miami, in which they were really highlighting the lack of representation of Black women artists in the arts industry. And so they had a lunch there at the PAM. They had two of their artists involved in an exhibition at the Prism Fair. And then they were really just trying to roll out the red carpet and increase that access for Black women artists.
That is a great way of transforming the way that we think about culture. But of course, this is the time of the year we think about traditions, the way that things have always been. And one tradition is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It's an Alliance Theater production at Cobb Energy Center going on now that has some surprises. What's the twist there, Kalundra?
Well, first of all, there's no shortage of Christmas Carol productions in Atlanta. So the Alliance production at Cobb Energy is one, but you also have Aurora Theater in Lawrenceville does their version, which, you know, for folks in out in OTP, so to speak, they can have that one. And then you have Of course, Dad's Garage does their own spin with Invasion Christmas Carol, where they totally muck up the story. So there's a lot of fun stuff there. And I know with the Alliance, they are at Cobb Energy until they move into their new space at the Woodruff. And so it'll be fun because they have some cast twists there, where it's not going to be everybody's used to seeing the same person play Scrooge, and it's going to be different this year.
Well, there you go. And there are also Nutcrackers going on everywhere. Is there any particular production that you loved most?
I mean, the Atlanta Ballet is always a surefire, you know, bet. And then, of course, the Georgia Ballet does a really beautiful production as well.
I also was really interested in Miss Bennett, Christmas at Pemberley. This is by the Georgia playwright Lauren Gunderson. So where's that production?
That's right here downtown at Theatrical Outfit. And this will be their second year staging that show. Lauren Gunderson has been one of the most produced playwrights in America, period, for the last couple of years. And she's right here from Atlanta, grew up, I believe, in Alpharetta. And that story is kind of a reimagined telling of a sequel to like a Pride and Prejudice. So it's going to find the Bennett sisters years later kind of questioning what does marriage and child rearing and all of that look like for them after Happily Ever After.
Floyd, one of the hottest tickets of this year has been Yayoi Kusama, Infinity Mirrors. That's a show at the High Museum, and the tickets sold out for the entire run of the show. High's been releasing about 100 walk-up tickets a day, pretty much bought before the museum even opens. What do you think, Calendra? Does the show live up to the hype?
I believe it does. I thought that the experience of going into each room and the whole idea behind it is for you to understand that we're all just one element in the universe. And I think the rooms do that really effectively. Floyd, I don't know what you thought about it, but
Floyd? I have not seen it, actually. So, yeah, I'm still on the outside looking in, trying to get my tickets. So I'll be walking up one of these days. So if you see me out there, please help me out.
So the show seems sort of perfectly suited for Instagram and other social media posts. Very photographical. Does it give viewers a real sense of Kusama in her work, do you think, Calendra?
I think that the rooms are very effective in doing that. I do think the crowds kind of, you know, the waiting in line in the crowds, you know, you have to just be prepared for that. But I think the experience of the rooms and seeing her paintings, actually her paintings were what impressed me most, honestly.
When if you can't get tickets like Floyd, maybe you have a little alternative here. Kusama's being represented at least at the Atlanta Botanical Garden. How is that happening?
So they have the Narcissus Garden, which are these like balls of mirrors that are all over the Atlanta Botanical Garden. So if you go to their holiday lights installation that they do every year, you'll be able to see that Kusama installation there as well. And it's really stunning.
On a much different scale, Calendra, you recommend Jiha, if I'm saying that properly, Moon's show at the Avery Art Company. What can you tell us about the artist and her work there?
So Jiha is at Allen Avery Art, and she's a Korean-American artist, and her pieces take their folk art, really vibrant, colorful folk art pieces that take inspiration not only from East Asia, but also from Latin America and from Africa. And so you see that kind of cultural amalgamation in her work.
And Floyd, you're recommending With Drawn Arms. This is Glenn Kino and Tommy Smith at the High Museum of Art. It's there until February. Seems pretty timely. Activism and highly visible athletes. Why, Floyd, do you recommend this show?
Well, Atlanta has a history as both a civil rights city and an Olympic city. So this exhibition, I think, is a great intersection with that identity of Atlanta. And so for this exhibition, it's presenting the 1968 protest moment that Tommy Smith and John Carlos made at the 68 Olympics in Mexico City. It's presenting that in an artful way by taking a cast, if you will, or a mold cast of Tommy Smith's arm, and really making it into a compelling art piece. And I think that for those who are paying attention to the current affairs with Colin Kaepernick and athletes and activism, this is one of those moments where you can look back 50 years and see another example of that.
So this is when they were standing on the podium getting their medals and they put their black gloved fists up in the air in the Black Power sign and suffered pretty great consequences because of it.
This is that moment, yes. And so if you go to that, there's some amazing memorabilia from Tommy Smith, who also is living in the Atlanta area. I think he lives in Gwinnett County. So it's a great moment to bring the past forward in a very interesting and amazing way.
Kalender, you also liked Michi Miko's It Doesn't Prepare You for Arrival. This is at the Museum of Contemporary Art of Georgia. Who is Michi Miko?
So Michi Miko is a local artist, and he has been working in Atlanta and slowly building from being a painter, doing some performance work, doing multimedia art. I mean, he's really explored and grown as an artist. And so this solo exhibition for him, I think, just comes right on time. And his work is dealing with all sorts of things from, you know, the fun, lighthearted stuff related to, like, the galaxy and exploration to some of the heavier things dealing with race and gender. So it is unlike anything you will see. I will say that. It is very unique and really beautiful.
So let's look at what we're looking forward to. I mean, these are all things that are on view right now. What about coming up for art or cultural shows in 2019? You want to start, Kalendra?
Sure. I would say that in terms of visual art, one thing that I'm really looking forward to is Amy Sherrill, who painted Michelle Obama for the National Portrait Gallery. She's going to have a solo exhibition at Spelman College. I believe she went to Clark Atlanta, so she has some history in this town. And this will be a solo exhibition for her in Atlanta, which I think I'm just excited to see what's there. They've had individual pieces of hers as a part of shows before, but for her to have a solo exhibition there, I think it's going to be really exciting.
So we know her from that portrait as a painter. Does she do other kinds of art, or is she just a painter? I mean, not just a painter, an extraordinary painter.
Well, the graying faces and bodies of, you know, that is her signature. So, but she does it so each portrait looks so different, so I'm excited to see the variety there, even with the graying.
Floyd, how about you? Is there something in particular that you are looking forward to in 2019?
Well, Kalendra sort of stole my thunder with the Amy Sherrill piece there. I just think that Amy is having just such a great moment. And it's funny, I saw Amy last year here in Miami for Art Basel. And it's amazing to just watch the evolution of her visibility and to see the response to her work. But on the other end of that spectrum, or I don't want to say maybe other end, there are some things on the arts calendar that I'm always excited about. And so one of my favorite moments of every year happens in February, and it's the City of Ink anniversary party. So this is a yearly event that is put on by Maya Bailey and the City of Ink sort of ecosystem of artists, if you will. So a lot of visual artists, creatives, if you will normally have the streets of Castleberry blocked off with a lot of revelry and excitement. So that'll be on my early to-do list for 2019.
All right, so that should brighten things up in February a bit. Kalendra, you also were excited about a production called Ever After at the Alliance Theater. Another take on a well-known tale, as we've heard a little bit of earlier. What's it about?
Yeah, so for those who are familiar with the Drew Barrymore film of the same name, it's a take on a Cinderella story. And so this will be a new musical, the first production that the Alliance will be doing on their new Coca-Cola stage. So that's very exciting. And of course, because they transferred The Prom to Broadway and that's having a successful run now, I'm sure that as they're developing Ever After, they probably have their eyes in that direction as well.
Kalendra Smith and Floyd Hall are with me. They're both arts journalists and Arts ATL contributors, and we're getting some suggestions for upcoming holiday events. We've heard those, some 2019 look forward to's, and some of the significant arts events from 2018. And among those that you really liked, Kalendra, this past year is the Color Purple play with Latrice Pace as Celie. This is at 11 Alives in the Spotlight in Atlanta. She's one of the Pace Sisters gospel group, and here's a little bit of her singing, I Am Here.
Got my eyes, though they don't see as far now. They see more about how things really are now.
You reviewed the play, Kalendra, for the AJC. How does it compare to Alice Walker's book and the 1985 film?
So Actors Express, I think, did a really phenomenal job with this production. In general, this past year for Atlanta musicals, like, I think everybody kind of got to a new level, whether you're talking about Freaky Friday at Horizon or Newsies at Aurora Theater. I mean, everybody just upped the ante. But The Color Purple, I thought, was just really special. And it's a stripped down version, and Actors Express is this small black box theater, and I was very skeptical about how they would pull it off. And I mean, it was so intimate, so engaging, and I mean, it was just a delight. As a reviewer, it's one of those shows where you put the pen down and you're just fully in it.
No, oh, and you also liked Woke, the play at the Essential Theater, and Titanic's run at the Serenby Playhouse. Quite a production, I understand.
Yeah, they sunk a ship. So
they went all in.
And they always do. I mean, that's Serenby's signature spectacle. So if you ever have a chance to drive down to the Serenby community, that's, you know, always a good time and something to do. And then with Woke at Essential Theater, I thought that Avery Sharp in general has been having a good year. He was in Black Nerd at Dad's Garage, and he wrote this piece Woke for the Essential Theater Play Festival. And I just thought it was a very different kind of play because it was about teenagers the summer before they were going off to college, and kind of examining how what's happening in America with race affects their friendships. And I just thought it was really cool to give voice to young people in that way that we don't see often.
So beyond the events themselves, wondering any big stroke themes in arts and culture from 2018. Floyd, I'm thinking iDrum gone now, Mammal now gone. But we have, you know, the big new $180 million venue in Sandy Springs. But at the other end of the spectrum, places like the Bakery, you know, much more DIY arts incubator space on the Beltline. What do you think is bubbling up here?
You mentioned the Bakery. I think they've done a really great job of stepping in where, as you mentioned, some of these other arts organizations have maybe been in transition. And I think that that's going to be a point of conversation, I think, in 2019, because Atlanta and the arts community is pretty vocal when it comes to how they feel about the state of things in the community and with the city, with affordability, and artists being able to make art in the city is still, it's not as certain as it once was. Mm-hmm. And so I have to really give some kudos to the Bakery for their programming and just the sheer volume of what they've done so far in the last year.
How about you, Kalender? What are you seeing for trends?
I would agree with that. I think you're going to see a lot more experimental, up-and-coming, emerging stuff popping up around Atlanta. I think, you know, of course, the big institutions will be fine, but I think it's going to be really about the little guy in 2019. And that has started to bubble up in 2018. If you look at East Point, where Tila Studios is, right next to them, you also have a new performing arts center, the Windmill Arts Center, where you have Fly on a Wall Dance Company in there, which is kind of an Atlanta Ballet offshoot, and they do really wonderful contemporary dance. You have Vanguard Rep, which they're producing nothing but local playwrights out there. And so it's going to really be about the emerging artist in 2019.
All right. So the not-so-little guys, T.I. and Childish Gambino, two of your picks. As we go out from this segment, Floyd, tell us what you were loving about them this year.
Well, This Is America from Childish Gambino still stands out as probably the best and most compelling 4 minutes of video that we saw in 2018. The song was really good, but the song was really in service to the video, which really captured a lot of emotion and imagery as it relates to the state of affairs in the world. And with T.I., in particular, T.I.'s performance at One Music Fest, I felt like that was a best of 2018 because of the triumphant nature of this hometown hero, if you will. So in that performance, he brought out a lot of guest appearances. He had his family on stage, and it just felt like a really great moment for someone who's been so visible and vocal about Atlanta for a long time.
Floyd Hall, Kalender Smith, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.